This is Peter Elting, Dreams and Their Enactment, April 14th, 2000.
One of the things that's outstanding about him is his traveling. So I would say Peter's a world traveler. He's on the go. And he's a man of action, which is probably the underlying reason for his interest in dreams and their enactment. So it's with pleasure that I introduce to you and welcome Peter Elting and welcome him back to Seattle.
Certainly fun to be here. It feels like home, and although the flight up here was just as usual too, you know, San Francisco rain, delayed, Mount Shasta, choppy air, you know, half a beer later, more choppy air, rain in Seattle, but then a wonderful non-fat latte at the airport made it all good. So then I walked around Green Lake and had another latte, so I feel I'm Seattleized again. So I think Lucretia did a very intuitive connection to action, because this is really what I want to talk about, how through action we can create another way yet to understand dreams, this mysterious language of the psyche, the source of that maybe helps us to understand the unknown. When I fidget around here with my glasses, I just recently had cataract surgery, which they tell me is a sign of rebirth and youth when you have that. But what they didn't tell me is that now I can neither really properly read with glasses or without glasses. So maybe I can see better inside now. But then, you know, my surgeon was not a Jungian analyst, so I can't really say that. So from the beginning, when I was in Zurich, I was very concerned and empathic to a lot of people I worked with who really had great difficulty to enter the dream through the associative process, because the temptation to go into some intellectualizing that was well known was so big. So it was always my sense that in my idea about dreams is I want to get as close to the images, because the psyche is a world of images. And if we cannot get to these images and to imaging, then we are really not getting close to that what lives in the psyche. And to get to images, we really have to find out where is where is the feeling, and where is the core of emotion in the dream. All other associations become wonderful and sometimes insightful, and sometimes, if you have a great knowledge, very mythical and very archetypal, and they have all these titles. But when you cannot get to the core of the emotion of that mysterious language of images, I don't think we are really in it. Then we cannot translate that symbol into reality. And this is my other walking stick, that I'm a great believer in the reality of the symbol. Sometimes it is helpful for me to translate a dream into something that has already been in the collective as a myth or a fairy tale or other archetypal patterns. And it's very helpful to see that something has been going on for a long time. But what symbol is the internet? Or what symbol is that reality life? I mean, you know, who today on the airplane was not talking about the stock market? That's all they were talking about. So we cannot really say that we can leave all this world out there and it has nothing to do with our inner psyche, only because Carl Gustav Jung around the turn of the century said you need to believe in the Greek and the Egyptian mythology. So I think a task in our modern times is also to translate these archetypal patterns into something that lives today. So here I'm already, I think on page 18, I have these very meticulous notes, but I'm an extrovert intuitive, and I don't look at them too often. So pardon me when I occasionally look down here, because otherwise we will go on an intuitive journey that you may get very tired of. How many of you have heard of active imagination? Ooh, wonderful. A very educated crowd. How many have heard of psychodrama or enactment or done it? Wonderful. Wonderful. How many of you work regularly with their dreams? Ah, less. How many of you feel that they have found their own way to work with their dream? Like a special way, something special, whatever that is. 2, 3, 4, yeah. And I only want to say with it, because there are many, many ways to work with the dream, and all we're talking today also, when we talk about enactment of the dream, dramatizing the dream through action, or when we use active imagination, all we're talking about is really another way, one other way to understand this language of images, or to put even in a different fashion, to even create the image. Let the dream create an image. Let the dream become an image. And Jung said in one very quick quote to that, that the psyche consists essentially of images. And he said that in Collected Works 8. And with it, he said all, because that's really what's happening. And in our culture, you know, we want to be creative and we want to make images, but we're doing them, you know, in a verbal, intellectual, and rather theoretical way. And I think what we neglect and what we avoid is the nonverbal, the intuitive, and the imaginative way. And possibly it's too risky, and possibly because it's more time-consuming. I find every time I'm in a dream group facilitating it, the biggest job I have is not to be smart and give archetypal backgrounds and interpretations to various people's dreams. No. What I have to be able to do is to hold the tension that's in the room of a dozen people, where everybody wants to interpret the dream as quickly as possible. And everybody has a wonderful interpretation ready. To hold that off is the main task, because you don't want to do it, because you lose the image. So, why active imagination? Well, I'm going to make a little... I'm struggling with this here just as much my eyesight. I don't know why this is. Should I struggle with this or just leave it? You can see I'm technically very versed. Active imagination. I mean, number one, I think it's a wonderful way for some of us to get closer to a dream. It's one reason. Number two, because I'm a man of action, and I feel an interaction with other psyches can add a lot to dream work. All of this in conjunction with therapy and analysis. I will never found to say that enactment and or active imagination can totally replace individual work when individual work is needed. It adds, it intensifies. It is a great augmentation. And tomorrow when we do the workshop, for those of you who are lucky to come, we will actually see it in action. We will warm up and we will become a group and we will trust each other after a while, and then we will have a chance to enact something. Well, we will see how that works, how powerful that can be. So, at the time I was in Zurich when I was introduced to active imagination, which for me, in my conviction, is essentially, and now many Jungians will rise up to defend their master, it's an introverted psychodrama. Now, I mean, to call Carl Gustav Jung a psychodramatist is quite a leap of faith, because he was probably singularly anti-groups or any grouping more than two, and said so many times. And I know when he was supposed to, he got a lot of pressure from all his wonderful early analysts in Zurich, Liliane Fry and Jacobi, Yolanda Jacobi. And they said, we have to start an institute. He said, an institute? Oh, my God, all these people in public? No way. So I think the story goes, whether it's myth or true, that Yolanda Jacobi went to Jung one day and said, Herr Professor Jung, we will start the new Catholic Jung Institute. And knowing how Jung felt about any kind of a denomination or religion, he said, oh, by God, he ran to somebody else and said, we immediately have to start a Jung Institute because there is a movement afoot to start a religious Jung Institute. So Jung was not. But when we look at active imagination and enactment, you will soon see, as I delineate it a little bit, that it is really Jung's introverted psychodrama. The segments of the interaction on an introverted way as part of active imagination are completely synonymous and parallel to the wonderful work that Jacob Levi Moreno did around the turn of the century at the same time, in the same collective, although Moreno and Jung, as far as we know, never met. Although Jung often was in Vienna, where Moreno originally came from, as the disciple of Freud, of course, as we all know. I will try to incorporate it in this time period. Lucretia, I have until I should finish moving my lips in an hour. Go. So, because I do want to leave some time for questions. So I will jump back and forth and you hopefully will be patient with me. I'd like to talk a little bit about Jungian dream theory, active imagination, Jungian psychodrama. And I even had in mind to maybe do a little role play here, demonstrative, but I think in my usual extroverted, ebullient fashion, it may be too much. But let's see where we can journey to. So, dreams, you know, you all are very well versed about dreams, and I'm just, you know, it's such an important piece around Jung that I just want to read just quickly a number of quotes that are plucked out of my vast library of Jung stuff. Dreams are spontaneous representations of the actual situation of the unconscious in symbolic form. They are a picture of what is going on in the unconscious. They are impartial, spontaneous products, a hidden door, an unknown text, a product of the total psyche, a spontaneous self-portrayal, a positive guiding idea. So I think with these quick quotes, you can see what an all-encompassing means and source to get closer to the unknown, how that was so important to Jung because he wrote and said so many things about it. And Jung is often used and often quoted today, but very little cited. It's a phenomena that I've never really quite understood, you know, but he gets forgotten a lot. At many universities where I teach, it takes an act of God almost to get a basic Jungian theory course in there, while everybody likes object relations and Kohut and Freud and whoever, and often they use Jungian principles. A very good friend of mine, you may have read some books by Patricia Garfield. She has published a number of books on women's dreams and other things. She was the president of the American, what is it called? ASD, American Society of Dreaming, where my colleague Robbie Bosnack also is a member and very active. And Patricia called me last week and she said, oh, Peter, I'm writing this new book and it's being published and it's great and it's wonderful and it's called Universal Dreaming. And I've been on the internet collecting dreams from all over the world. And it's so exciting for me to see. I'm finding similar patterns in all nations and cultures and age groups. I said, you must have been reading Jung's volume so-and-so about the collective unconscious. He said, well, what is that? So I explained it to her, and she was rather chagrined that she thought she had invented and discovered something wonderful. But to see how, I mean, she has a publisher who's very enthused about her book, you know, so now she has invited me to read the book and write a little foreword to it. I will see whether I do that once I read the book. Dreams have a strange place in our society, you know, because when we talk about dreams as such, or when we use the word, we call people, when you say you're a dreamer, it isn't necessarily positive. You know, it is sort of something, well, you're not quite with it. You don't really get the reality of life. So it has that colloquial and negative connotation. And, you know, and it goes on, they are dreaming, or what a dreamer. Well, it's sort of judgmental about somebody who is, as I said, not quite with it. So, this always, referring to something unreal, is really then the task that the dreaming part, the unconscious, we have to bring it into something that is meaningful in our waking life. For me, dreams have always been the greatest road, the royal road to the emotional core of the unconscious. But we also have to be respectful of people. Some of my more learned colleagues who write big, very popular books about sleep and dreams. And one quote I saw the other day that I thought I couldn't really read it to you, but I'll share it with you anyhow. They call dreaming is just the replenishment of neurotransmitters. So there you go. You know, this puts Jung's five volumes just into one sentence. So I'm sure Jung was not aware that he just wrote about the replenishment of neurotransmitters. And I think it's unfair to take the mythical and the religious and all the other aspects away from dreams when we look at dream history, when we look at, you know, how many hundreds of years before Christ, Asclepius worked with dreams in such a meaningful way, how they entered the religious field in the Bible, the dreams of Joseph, dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, all these meaningful interpretations at that time. It is true, though, that then the Christian area actually poo-pooed dreams in the sense they valued the rational and thought dreams were really disturbing their way of religion. They didn't want to have something unknown and mythical, it seems. It was Freud who brought it up again. And Jung, you know, split from Freud very quickly because he thought dreams had something that was very prospective and positive rather than just this retroactive, reductive garbage pail or representation of something that we wished or had not worked on. Let's sort of a very synthetic little dream image of a 42-year-old woman who was the head nurse at a big hospital, and she had been in a relationship for quite a while with a man, and she had extreme relationship difficulties. And at the time she had this dream, of course the woman does not exist, but so you don't have to worry that I'm sharing here secrets. Although it is clear also, as there is clinical material coming in here, I always say, you should treat it with a certain amount of confidence. I give you the dream. The dream is, I'm walking on the beach, and since somebody is behind me, I continue to walk, but finally turn around, and I see a big black man who seems to follow me. When I go faster, so does he. This must have been an important page. It didn't print. But luckily the dream goes on. Finally, I run away from the beach into the woods and wake up. It's a very archetypal dream. Probably I and most of you who had dreams had at one point or the other a dream when somebody follows you, this principle of the doppelgänger, to use this wonderful German word, the double that Jung had developed and written about many times. Of course, it's an aspect of the shadow. It's also a dream that shows very clearly the dramatic dream structure of exposition, development, culmination, and lysis. So it has this good drama structure. So, you know, when we look at dream, and I'm going to go through this very quickly because I have a sense you're very familiar with Jungian dream theory and as such, so I can shorten this. So the dreamer was very scared when she woke up from this dream. Well, not surprising, so would I be. And she shared further on, whenever she's in trouble, she walks on the beach. And she has been afraid of something, and she had many dreams with somebody following her. So quickly we could find out that she doesn't really know any big black man in reality life. So it is some subjective aspect of her rather than an objective happening. So here, you know, I quote you a bit of Jung. He says, the unconscious, and it has to do with the compensation. What does it compensate? The unconscious contents breaks through in the form of a dream and spontaneous image. As a rule, the unconscious compensation does not run counter to consciousness, but is rather balancing or supplementing to the conscious orientation. So we could fantasize, we know that, you know, whenever we have somebody following us, or when there is a fear, there is a lack of, often we see the pattern in dreams, you have somebody following, well, the development in the work with ourselves is, in this dream, the woman was not ready, the dreamer was not ready to confront. So the dreamer ran into the woods, and that was the end of the dream. Well, the evolution of it would be that maybe a half a year later, a similar dream comes, and the woman stops, or the protagonist stops on the beach, faces the perpetrator, and says, hold it a minute, I'm tired of you following me around. And the third dream may be, hold it a minute, what do you want, what's going on? So we move to that stage. You know, Jung wrote about in this way also, we need to face this shadow aspect in the dream. When he reported on this wonderful Swiss priest who had been dreaming about whores and alcoholics and all this, and he came to Jung and said, I don't understand, Dr. Jung. I'm such a wonderful man. All people think I'm very pious. I'm very clean. I'm happily married. I have two children. This is the Reformist Church in Switzerland. So Jung listened to all of that, and then finally, slowly, he gave the priest the insight that we all have the dark and the shadow in us, and the murderer or the perpetrator in us. And also as a priest, he needed to acknowledge that, and the more he pushed it away, the more it came back, and so the dreams got more intense and more intense, and when he consciously realized it, the dreams stopped. So in all this in this work with this dreamer, the 42-year dreamer, she understood her dilemma. And that she was also very demanding in her relationship and challenging to her partner at times. But she couldn't really quite get to some emotional aspect. What was it really? Because it was hers, you know, it kept being projected onto something else, a situation or a partner. So it seemed like she was not quite able to get to that emotional core so quickly. So when Jung found similar patterns like this, it was clearly the time when he stayed in Bollingen, very much alone, around 1912 to 14, just after he had split from Freud. And he was very much involved in his inner life. And it was that time that he discovered active imagination, the engagement of these inner figures and characters in an active way. And active imagination is a dialogue with the unconscious. You know, we engage the inner figures out of the dream or fantasy in a dialogue, and we record this. It's something that should flow, and the emphasis is really on the word active. It's not a guided imagery. It's not a relaxation exercise. You have to have a conscious ego that gets involved. You also challenge these inner figures. And Robert Johnson was probably the one who wrote for me the clearest about it. Barbara Hanna and Gene Chodorow and many others have published very good seminal works on active imagination. But Robert Johnson, I think in his volume on inner work, did the most clear job, also exemplatory, to lead us to the process of active imagination. And he said the need for active imagination, he called, first is horse trading. It's needed to negotiate with your inner figure to find the new. That's one aspect of it. Compromise and bargain. It's really a dialogue that goes back and forth. Then he talked about the embracement of the unconscious, that we're trying to get acquainted with the unconscious in our inner figures. That's the reason. And thirdly, you know, we can experience a spiritual dimension through the work of inner, of active imagination. Jung, of course, the most famous figure that he found, or that found, who found him in his active imagination, with those well-known figures, the was Philemon, and there were a number of others who became great sources of his work when he was deeply depressed, if not close to a psychotic break. He didn't break because he always had a very good relationship to the reality around him. He was in Bollingen, he built the tower, he regularly saw his patients, and he regularly was, of course, with his wife Emma and the kids. So he made sure he kept that reality base. And so it is also, you know, very much coming from a Jungian standpoint that I am so convinced that we need to bring as much as we can everything into a reality based out of our dream world and try to translate the image into something that we live today. I know when I did my early training, and I keep sort of having these splurts here, so you forgive me if I transgress too much, but I think these little anecdotes as they appear out of my feeble psyche here, which, by the way, I thought the psyche really looks like this. Unfortunately, I don't have a transparency. It's a caricature out of the New Yorker, and you're happy to, you can pass it around if you like to. I don't have a transparency of it. And the other way to show you how important dreams are to me is that I and so I can't really write down the dream. And I had a dream not too long ago, and I was on a flight. And those cocktail napkins make great dream recordings, you know. And so don't ever let your resistance play this trick on you. Also, just as a side, a very good friend of mine started painting the other day and had a very deep psychic experience and an Ausananda Setsung, and he came up with this surrealistic painting of two faces. So you can see also that can be an expression of the psyche. The important part to see there is, of course, as you have this representation, is what the negative space, the Mephistolian space in the middle that got created without knowledge. That's where the unconscious completely flowed in. The two figureheads on the right and left were done consciously. And I say, I want to do two figureheads maybe. But what the two figure, the outlines of the faces created in the middle is totally unconscious. Small aside. I know the painter rather well. But Jung also made clear that while there is the importance of engaging the inner figure in whatever aspect In our case, maybe a dark shadow aspect in the dream, or Philemon, in a very active dialogue in the course of active imagination, we should not become this figure. We should not symbolize this figure. We should make sure that this figure is. I'm struggling with my eyesight here and the microphone. That the figure stays the figure and a person, that it doesn't become, that we don't reduce it with our great insight, especially as Jungian analysts, to some wonderful archetypal piece. It needs to be a personal figure. It needs to stay Philemon, the figure I can converse with. So while Jung said, yes, of course, Philemon for me was the wise old man, but he always said, and that's something I know, but when I talk to him, he's Philemon. He's not the wise old man. And he has to prove it to me every time. And sometimes he succeeds that he's really the wise old man, and sometimes he fails. And that's how he stays a figure. So, our introverted psychodrama, active imagination. How many of you, oh, I already asked you, how many of you do so? I presume you do. Also know how this works for you. It is always with a word of caution that I mention active imagination and also enactment. It is not like it's not candy. It's not like eating some wonderful dessert and you're getting inside every time you do it. It's a somewhat dangerous activity. You can bring yourself to the brink of something unknown that is very powerful. So do it with respect. It's also when you do active imagination and you're in analysis, the danger that you do it just for your analyst is also there. So make sure you check that, or your therapist. Don't become a producer. Make sure it stays personal and you're not producing it for somebody else. You need a block of time. I'm giving you some of the things that I think are important. You need to be alone. Don't think of inviting your best friend to sit there with you. Maybe your dog can lie at your feet. Mine does. And you have to be in a comfortable space, you know. Give yourself a break, you know. Don't do it, you know, sitting on the most uncomfortable chair and shut off the heat, you know. Be comfortable. And then you invite the unconscious to empty the ego mind, the steps. You dialogue and you experience. Then you value the dialogue. You put it into perspective of a moral value. And then you make it concrete and you bring it into the reality of life. What did it mean to you? What does it mean to me? So let me elaborate a little bit on that. So let's say first step, you do some kind of a ritual. You get comfortable. Light a candle. Select your media. How are you going to do this active imagination? I like to do it these days. You know, we're in the age of the computer. Jung did it, of course, by handwriting. I do it on the computer, on the word processor. You have to write down the question and the answer. And it has to be a challenging interchange. So what I, for instance, do, and I'm not saying that this is the only way to do it, because, of course, you can do it with graphic material and other things, too. I type the questions, I leave them all in capitals, and the answers all in small letters. That way, I never get confused later on when I read it. Jung said, the creative activity of imagination frees man from this bondage to the nothing but and raises him to the status of one who plays. It's a wonderful quote, and Moreno, or any action-oriented enactment or psychodramatist, could have said the same thing, and we would have all said, well, he's right on, because that's where creativity and spontaneity come from. The first stage in the active imagination is very similar to the psychodrama phase of warming up. You know, we warm up as a group, we warm up to the idea that we want to enact and what we want to enact. So then in active imagination, you give it form as a second step. The form is that you have to write down question and answer, that you're really in a dialogue. You ask questions. whoever the protagonist, the antagonist is that you're dealing with, or it may also be an aspect, you know. I mean, I'm expanding that from a psychodramatic view. Surely it is easier to do an active imagination, a dialogue with a person. But if some non-personal thing appears all the time, you can psychodramatize it, you can personalize it, you can ask it. And it could work. It doesn't work so well. It works better in psychodrama when that it or piece or aspect of the psyche is represented by a person, because then you have another psyche that enters with the energy. But be vigilant. Be vigilant as much as you are in your conscious life. Ask questions. Don't accept what this other figure says in the active imagination. You know, find out what it is. After the confrontation that you had with this figure, with the unconscious, you have to give it some value. You have to give it a moral judgment of some sort. You give it ethical value. You need to participate. Because if you don't do this, you just remain a bystander. After the confrontation with the unconscious, it is very helpful if we can translate that emotional piece into the reality of today. Where does it apply in my life today? That's where the reality comes in. That's where it becomes helpful. There are always valid resistances to it. Active imagination, not unlike dream work. You know, we have valid resistances and lousy excuses. So it's, we have to weigh it very carefully. You know, it's, it reminds me of the story on dreaming. I was giving a talk in Switzerland, in Caen, Montana, to a bunch of psychologists and consultants and so on, executive coaches and all these fine folks, and I was trying to tell them that Jungian work was really very helpful in their field, and they kind of sat there stone-faced like only the Swiss can do for 2 hours in a row. And they said, then we had a question and answer period, and somebody said, well, I don't remember my dreams. What does that mean? I wake up all the time. And I said, well, sometimes it is because when we are very, very busy in our conscious life, then the unconscious shuts off too quickly, or we don't let it bloom at that one moment when the dream appears early in the morning. So all good and done, they applauded dutifully and said I must have given them a wonderful speech, and so they were happy. I felt pretty good about myself. Then the grand patron, the president of the company, came to me afterwards and he said, oh, Dr. Elting, it was a wonderful speech. I did not understand anything you said about this Jung and how it can help in my business. But he said, you said something very valuable. Now when I go into my employee's office, I will only ask him, did you remember your dream? And when he says yes, he's obviously not working hard enough. So I said, you see, there is an application of Jungian theory in your business. You just didn't know it. So, with that in mind, of course, without going into the detail of it, active imagination, as much as enactment, has a lot to do with, you know, the theory of opposites and finding the, finding some aspect of the transcendent function. You know, finding that third out of this dialogue that we have, out of this Auseinandersetzung, as this fine German word is. And Jung says the confrontation of two positions generates a tension charged with energy, and that generates a living third and not a logical stillbirth. But a movement out of the suspension between opposites, a living birth that leads to a new level of being, a new situation. And, you know, it is all these aspects, I think, are leading back to Jung's basic concept of the psyche, of what makes us live, is that there are always opposites at work that create tension, and that when we are able to hold the tension, we will generate something that can be very helpful and wonderful in our life. And we don't really have to know how it all works. We just need to accept the images as they appear. So you remember the dream. I'm walking on the beach, and since somebody is behind me, I continue to walk, but finally turn around. I see a black man who seems to follow me. When I go faster, so does he. Finally, I run away from the beach into the woods. So the dreamer wants to do an active imagination with that figure and sits down and does everything and now starts asking questions, which are sort of the basic questions whenever you see an inner figure appear so precisely in a dream. Who are you? Very simple question. What do you want? Why do you follow me? Why are you on the beach? Will you talk to me? And so on. And one question in a good Socratic fashion will lead to another. This is not psychodrama. This is active imagination. Otherwise, I would ask two of your most courageous people to come up here and we would do a role play on it. But maybe we'll do it later in a psychodramatic fashion. Moreno and Jung never met. And, you know, when I talk about this, the interactional and more extroverted protagonist-centered psychodrama, I incorporate all Jungian aspects in my head, of course, because I'm a Jungian analyst. So the archetypal background of the work, whether it's dreams or whether it's a life situation or whether it's anything, will always be in the background of my head. For me, the concept of self that Moreno developed, and I'm saying it only briefly, for Moreno, in his more extroverted way, he thought that our central being was constellated through the learning and the experience in a divine fashion of new roles through creativity and spontaneity. We had to learn new roles in life, and the more roles we were comfortable to have, the more of our central self was in a happy state or in a state of well living. Now, when I tense the bow again fully and say and take a big courageous leap forward, and I could say, well, and for Jung, the process was very similar, except it was all in an intrapsychic, introverted fashion. For Jung, it was the inner psychic tension that needed to be done in order to get to the self. And the search for both Moreno and Jung, they searched for the divine in mankind, and their highest value was individual authenticity, and they both share that in common. One clearly came from the outside in, and one from the inside out. And Moreno's self, of course, in the end, we have to say, is not, it's not a Jungian self. It's not that famous self with a capital S. It's not the central archetype. I mean, I don't want to get too developmentally psychological, but I would think Moreno's self is more of an ego self. It does not have the Jungian sense. But nonetheless, it is a central, in a central sense. And Jung really was a great phenomenologist. You know, he developed his whole theory through the phenomena as they appeared to him. So he was very much open to new experiences, just as much as Moreno said, we have to have these experiences through interaction, through spontaneity and creativity to get on in life. So the interaction is, I think, with both. The interaction is needed for both, one on the inside and one on the outside, to create that aspect of the divine and get closer to the unknown and be authentic.
So what is psychodrama? I know I'm tasking you here quite a bit by throwing these things out, but I try to tie them together in the end a little bit, and I hope then you have a feeling that what we're really talking about all evening in one fashion or the other are the various ways to get closer to this mysterium of dream, this language of images that every time we look at a dream throws us for a loop, and we say, my God, now I just thought I had read this fine new book on dreams, now I thought I really had it all in me. I know exactly what's happening. And here comes the psyche and produces yet another script that has nothing to do with it, that you have never encountered before, and that maybe throws in another, you know, the psyche knows no time and space. So the most, every time that my psyche wants to confuse me, it really does away with the concept of time and space. You know, this is always very difficult. You know, I'm 6 years old, but I'm wearing a business suit, and the young lover I'm chasing looks like my mother, and it goes on and on and on. And I know I've gotten too clever about myself, and I need to retract to the basics. Psychodrama techniques are designed to incomes that is surprising to us, because the aspects of the drama, and you will see this demonstrated very well and very safely, I may add, and also playfully and with humor. You can probably, as having experienced me for the last 45 minutes, you know that I feel play and humor in the most serious work are a part and parcel of it that is very, very important and very, very helpful. So my group work reflects that too. To just make sure that we have a temenos, a vessel that is airtight, because only then can you do good work. So a rigidly defended person, you know, who we all encounter, if not in ourselves, in others, you know, where the resistances are so well trained, and you know, all of the Freudian aspects are well in place, and denial, you know, we practice denial so well that it is sometimes very difficult to distinguish that what we deny from the real content of life. When some aspect of that or in a dream is put into an enactment, we lose control over it. It is action. So that's when the enactment brings about an integration that we cannot really reach by an associative process in talking about it or associating to it. The action brings in time. It brings in past, present, and future in a way that is demonstrated through people who help us play in this action method. I mean, we need the past to get in touch with some of our childhood experiences and emotions that are in us. And the present is where we live. And, you know, when talking about the here and now and this famous Gestalt principle that says we need to look at everything in the here and now, and I'm not against that at all, but Fritz Perls was a student of Moreno and not the other way around, so we know where he came from. So let me just quickly delineate when I say enactment or psychodrama, what that means or how that works. So let's say we are in a group and we do a first stage, what we would call a warm-up. It's really what the word says, you know, when 10 strangers are in a room looking at each other somewhat anxiously and saying, I wonder what's going to go on here. You know, it's obviously that I cannot jump in there and I say, great guys, we're here to do dream work, drama, who wants to do it? You do it, let's go. Because we would all sit there and nobody would move. So it takes a warm-up, a psychic warm-up with respect and slowness so that everybody has a chance to speak and we collectively build a safe vessel in which we can do the work. Because if we don't have a cauldron, if we are not becoming alchemists, if we don't have a vessel in which we can cook, the work is useless. Because when it's so leaky, then we will individually not adopt the work. It's similar to when I have the suspicion, or should I have the suspicion, that my therapist talks about me at cocktail parties or various other things. It's hard to do good work when that is even the remotest possibility. After the warm-up comes an enactment. A protagonist, the dreamer, let us say, will pick people who play various parts, persons, or things. In the case of our little, see how powerful dreams, I try to not get too close to them, so my unconscious quickly slips in this word little, this little dream, because it's not a little dream at all. It's a rather big dream. So this dream, in this dream, hypothetically, the protagonist would be the protagonist, the dreamer, and she would obviously pick this big black person. I, as a director, may suggest some other people or other aspects in it that I know from her life. We would put somebody there that she has most closely associated to this black person in her present life. And that could be anybody. It could be the man she lives with, for instance. There could be an aspect could be there, or it could be her father, or whoever it was, but somebody in the real life. And then many other things get picked. You know, I would be tempted to, for instance, say, who would want to play the beach? Because it's curious that she always goes to the beach. So obviously the beach has a meaning. So we'll have the beach speak. Often I work with a dedicated auxiliary ego. This is a big name for somebody who helps the protagonist to stay truthful and authentic. He or she walks behind the protagonist and encourages and challenges and speaks in the I form, as an I, as I the protagonist. If the protagonist moves on into some great length of theoretical, intellectual, wonderful explanations, the alter ego behind the protagonist may say, how do I feel? And the protagonist would say, what does feeling have to do with it? Didn't you listen to what I said? I want to know how you feel. Role players, people who play in these dream dramas, have to be introduced. So they get introduced in a specific fashion, in as much as the protagonist introduces the role players themselves. So, you know, it goes very simply, you move behind. Done in many types of enactment, when you talk about something, it doesn't subjectify, go so deeply into you right away as if you talk as somebody. We'll do it some more tomorrow. So within psychodrama, which is very interactional and relation-oriented, any feeling, any aspect, any piece, any person can be enacted and played and incorporated in the drama as we see fit, as the protagonist and the director agree. Various ways to go about it. There is the technique of doubling. Somebody from the group comes in and expresses his or her feeling standing behind the protagonist. I feel like I want to talk to my mother or my father. It's an expression of this other person, what it moved in somebody else. As I speak here, many of you have this image or that image. I'm sure not all images are the same. So sometimes it's helpful for a protagonist to hear that. Sometimes it may not be true at all, and it doesn't matter, because if I hear what's totally wrong, I get closer to what may be right for me. So it's helpful no matter what. Then not to load you down with too many, let's say, techniques, is role reversal. It is something that is also... How many of you are practicing therapists in the group? A few. It's essentially where, you know, the protagonist takes over the role that he has assigned. So when I have a conversation within the drama with my father or my mother or a dark shadow, and I have this conversation, then after a while I may role reverse, and that the protagonist has to answer his or her own questions. So if in this case I ask the dark shadow, "Who are you?" may answer, "I'm whatever." I don't want to do it now because we may do it in reality. Oh, maybe not. And I may ask more probing questions. I may ask questions like, why are you here? Why are you following me? Well, at that point, I would probably say role reverse, which means the protagonist moves into the place of the dark person and will answer that question herself. That, at a certain level, forces the psyche, forces is too strong a word, encourages the psyche to really answer on a feeling, emotional level, what is going on, so that this dark part gets identified on an emotional level for the protagonist more closely. I use that aspect of psychodramatic technique and enactment also in my private analytic practice. Sometimes I have a client come in and we talk for a long time about a dream. And the question, where is the main feeling in the dream, at this point cannot be answered. The client may be too defended or whatever, at this point cannot answer it. And I may do what I call a monodrama right there in the room. I will assign a chair, the empty chair, to that aspect that is the main part in the dream, and have the analysis on role reverse with it. And it is sometimes very helpful. Because again, it moves us away from talking about it into the action part, which means I'm becoming it. And I have led psychodrama groups every month, and it's always amazing to me how through this process of trusting interaction, in the morning as a dozen souls we sit together there and we look at each other anxiously and saying, "Oh my God, you know, what's going to go on here? I have to act? Oh, my stuff? Oh, no, not me." Or some of us sit there, "I have really nothing to hide," you know, and then everybody is surprised what comes out. And at the end of a weekend, you know, we are so closely together, we're kind of scheming of all wanting to go on an island on a vacation together. Symbolically speaking, I mean, it has never happened. So we still have this dream. Now, and we have a few minutes. Are there two people in the room who would be interested to come up here for a second? And really sticking to the dream, I don't want any personal involvement because this is strictly a demonstration, who feel they can keep a distance from the dream and yet kind of one could be the protagonist and one could be the man. So we could do just a quick demonstrative role, and with a little bit of a role reversal, to see what happens when and if just a few questions get asked. Great enthusiasm here. Courage, spontaneity, creativity. I see one hand up. I see two. That's all I need is two. You were first, you were second. two chairs we need. We have them here.
Has emotion in it, so you know, I felt warm. I mean, I could have gone on for another hour. This was going to be wonderful. You know, it was really, it was moving into something that gave a totally different dimension as to when I imagine I just talk about the shadow aspect to somebody, talk about it, suddenly being it. So I think that was very, very nice, and I thank both the volunteers. So, I mean, for me as a Jungian analyst, it's always very important to find new ways to get to this secret, this psyche of images, and to get closer to those images. And I think enactment is a wonderful way to do it. So is painting, so is active imagination, so are many, many other ways. And I'm sure you have your own ways, and so is meditation, and so is some Gestalt practice. I mean, there are many, many ways. And, you know, and I can say also as Jungian analysts, we need to be very open to these new ways to be in a mode of realism in today's world. You know, I was very serious when I said that the reality of our life around us is different from the turn of the century. And the web and the internet and this whole aspect of globalization and profits and business. Sure, in its pure sense, they're brutal and they're tough aspects, but they're still part of our collective today, and we're encountering them all the time. And there is a German analyst colleague of mine who I respect very much. He wrote a very insightful article that he called Today's Magnum Opus, Today's Big Work of the Soul. Today's Magnum Opus of the Soul, where he reflects on today's reality. And, you know, the stock market and all this stuff, all has its own psychology that is reality in our life, and we cannot do it away. I know initially when I trained in Zurich, my first training analyst, when I reported on the first sessions, I had a couple of people who were in very deep trouble in their real life. He told me, he said, I don't think you're doing really, after about 10 reports to him, I don't think you're doing real analytic work. You just talk about life. And I looked at him and I said, and thank God I'm alive. Yeah, but where is the depth? I said, the depth is right there. If I cannot slowly wean the depth from the reality of life where the pain is, then how can I do analysis? But there was this ill-conceived notion by some early on that in order to do real deep analysis, you couldn't talk about these mundane things of everyday life. And, you know, it is this moral response of good or bad, in my opinion, is a great fallacy and is very, very premature, and premature condemnation will always block us away from finding the gold in that shadow that Jung said. You know, if we just keep pushing this dark man away, if we don't confront him, if we don't go to the next stage, by whatever means we have, if we always run back into the woods and the shadow keeps the same distance, there is no growth. We have to confront. And, you know, we can do it. Jung said in volume collective work number 9, he said, and I'm, of course, I abbreviated the quote a little bit to serve my purpose better. Guilty.
But he said, this self, however, is the world. That's the only time he admitted that the world really has a meaning also as far as the self goes. And, you know, today, you know, I live in San Francisco, and you'd be amazed how many clients of mine dream about the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a big outer symbol. Well, and the meaning of the Golden Gate Bridge is so multifold. It's so wonderful. You know, for some, it's a symbol that may, crossing it, may be a new beginning. Others think about, my God, they start painting the bridge on one end, and when they have ended at the other end, they start at the other end again. So they're thinking, oh my God, what a futile endeavor. One client of mine thought, well, it's really the symbol for analysis. And I said, ooh, that doesn't sound so good. It's a symbol for transference, or it's a crossing to a new beginning. So I think my message to you tonight, again, is that I want you to stay open to let the real image and the real symbol appear. Don't condemn anything that your psyche and your images comes up. And if it's a computer, well, take the computer as your symbol for the moment and work with it. An Excel bar chart that a client brings in because he wants to show me how he expects the intensity of intimacy to rise during analysis is just as important as if the client brings me in a piece of fine art that represents his most wonderful archetypal dreams. It's all in there. We just need to accept it, because otherwise images will not go. And it was already in 1781 that my great hero, because I had to slave through him, having been brought up in Germany and having to go through 9 years of a humanistic gymnasium, I also had to delve into Immanuel Kant. And whoever of you have ever read this fine German philosopher, know that it is not an easy task. But already in 1781, you know, he pointed to his process of images, and he called it Einbildungskraft. And that's where Jung and also Hillman got this idea of images and the psyche of images. I'm sure Jung read a lot of Kant. And for him, and also for me, it is the absolute precondition of any knowledge about ourselves. Without that, without getting in touch with those images, and if we continue to condemn them and interpret them away, there's no chance. I think I have started to try to close a number of times, but I think I'm very much right on time here. Right, Lucretia? Thank you, Lucretia. But now really I'm closing, and I know I've tried it before. And I'm going to leave you with a poem by T.S. Eliot, of course, from none other than The Wasteland. And it's entitled Burial of the Dead. No, sorry. It's entitled Burial of Dead. And I will show you something different from either. Your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you, I will show you fear in a handful of dust. So it is this juxtaposition of the shadow. In the morning it's behind us, in the evening it meets us. When we look at that, then we should really not try to escape it. And we should try to make those images as they appear in our dreams come alive with any means we have at our disposal, whatever way. And I certainly, in closing, want to invite no more than 20 of you, but that many, to come tomorrow so we can play a little bit and practice this. My favorite saying of Jung's that I want to definitely close with now, this is my third attempt to close, is Jung's saying, he starts the prologue in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, the book that I think I like best of Jung because I was the first one I read of him, where he says, life is a story of self-realization of the unconscious. And that's really what it's all about. So I continue to believe in this and embrace our daily life with feeling and emotion that it deserves. So thank you. I hope I see some of you tomorrow. And thank you for listening to my intuitive ramblings here. You were a great audience, and I enjoyed sharing this with you. Absolutely. I'll stay here all night. I'd love to talk to you. No problems. So let's take a short break, and then how long a break, Lucretia? 15 minutes? Absolutely. Almost everybody harvested here who is curious and interested and has many questions. Are there any questions at all, or should we go drink a beer somewhere? Maybe both. Yeah. Let me clear this up for you. It's a very good question, thank you. And I'm certainly very happy to speak to it, especially from that sense. I was not clear, obviously, when I said objective and subjective. While it's true that we have the tendency, and we could and should, when there is a known place, a known city, known people, that we look at it objectively, and when it's totally unknown of everything and schema and, you know, maybe not even quite a person, we have the tendency to say, well, maybe that's a subjective aspect of our psyche. And it is important to look at both ways all the time. Okay? So while in this particular case the dreamer did not specifically know any tall black man, it is still important to look at the objective aspect of the dream. She's walking on the beach and encountering this figure, and to work around that. And then automatically, I think, one very quickly, or the dreamer, will go into something else, because there is no objective man, and, you know, and then it moves itself in onto a different level. Yeah. It's never an either or. With me ever, but we haven't met before, so you didn't know that. It's always an and or, you know. It's very important to keep that in mind. It's both. Does that help you a little bit? Well, there is a big trickster in the psyche, and often it's done deliberately, but it's very valid to ask, why did the psyche represent this or that in that way? So now, you know, let's say the expression of masculinity can show up in the dream as a hero fighting a dragon. It can show up as my grandfather. It can show up as some replica of myself. It can show up as my godfather. It can show up as all sorts of things, you know. And it may have that feeling of it does represent some aspect of my masculinity. And then the only way that I think that I know best to get closer to it, to really ask this question, why does the psyche bring this up now? And why in this form? And then, you know, you keep really questioning around this all the time to get a sense for it. I'm not saying you're always successful. We're not always successful with it. But then we get more of a fabric, you know, we have more of an image. Remember, as I talked about images, this is how you create an image. When you want to make an image that is bigger than what you just see concretely, this person, you need to enrich it with associative questioning around it, open questions around it. And then suddenly it's like weaving a tapestry. Then you have an image, and then it may make sense, more sense. May still make no total sense, but may make more sense. Betty. Yes. Certainly can be a trigger, yes. And you, maybe you want to keep asking yourself other questions. What made me dream in Africa? I'm just throwing out some questions that come to my mind as I heard you talk. Is what does Africa mean to me? What do black people do mean to me? What's my relationship to tribal traditions? Where is my tribe? You know, big questions come up. And that's the nice part about enactment as well as active imagination. It opens up this catalog of questions. You know? Pardon? Sure. You know, where in Africa, what is it? Are people in it? What people? Animals, what animals, what do I see, what's going on? How do I feel about it? How do I feel about Africa? Is it the dark continent? Is it maybe a shadow aspect? Is it the dark part of the psyche? Often it represents that. Jung traveled to Africa extensively. You know, sometimes modern times make different things. You remember Jung wrote about his trip to Africa. And, you know, he asked some of the Bushmen about their dreams, their big dreams, and they said, well, ever since we have the British colonial administrator here doing all the work for us, we don't have to dream anymore. He does it for us. So there went the tribal tradition of following the big dream of the medicine man. Sure, yeah. It's all very valid consideration, yeah. I'm not going to interpret the dream for you, Betty. But it's true. You're so alert and so wonderful, as we could see here. You have no problems, I think, putting yourself into a little meditative Socratic mode and just fire away all these questions. And I'm sure it'll warm up the image of Africa for you. Yes, please. I mean, it depends on your typology, how you function best. To put it on such a regular basis or force myself into anything wouldn't work for me. But I mean, you know, there are people who are operating more in a thinking and sensate function, and it works perfect for them. And that's the only way it would work for them. So I think we need to be open to all of it. I don't do it regularly. I don't do it all the time. I do ask myself core questions around my dreams. And when I feel something hits, I hang on to the dream and I work with it. But it, you know, it's not like when I was in training in Zurich and I had this very harsh training analyst who I saw twice a week who said, and you will bring me your dreams, please, typed up, double-spaced, every time. So that's of course, you know.
Yes, please. 20 is an absolute maximum. 12 is the most favorite number. Yeah. Good. Yeah, on protagonist, on individual dreams, yeah. Right, surely. Yeah, that aspect of the dramatic work is called sociodrama. When I out of the individual dreams, I do it when I have very big groups. Sometimes it happens at conventions, and I was just in New York, and I had a group of 40 people, and that's what I did there. Put people in small groups first of 4 or 5 or 6 to share the dreams, so everybody has a chance to warm up. Then out of these 6, they decide on what is the leitmotif, as Jung called it so fine, the leading theme of that group, bring it into the larger group, discuss it, see where the commonality is, and do a sociometric choice as to what theme the group wants to work on. Same thing. Act it out, same thing. Same thing. Except it then has been moved away somewhat from the individual, from an individual protagonist into more of a social thing, you know, like you can do a sociodrama on you know, any aspect of life, you know, on the job world or on road rage or whatever you want to, whatever is in the group, or on relationship, you know. I always do a sociodrama on relationship because everybody can contribute an aspect and is ready to go. Suddenly you have no audience. Everybody wants to act, you know. So, and the same just to fill up that, the other possibilities that I also do is do bibliodrama, in which case we take biblical scenes and enact them. Very powerful work. And the next thing that I do is fairy tale enactment. We take a fairy tale. And it all works very similar, but it's all different. You know, I mean, bibliodrama moves very, very slow and very, very careful because you don't want to, you know, and not like, well, you don't want to act like young Jacob Moreno in Vienna when he was so enthralled with his own divinity. I mean, he was quite a egomaniac in many ways, and he was standing on the table and he had worked so hard on the role of God, because he was God. He was standing on the table and everybody else was down here, that he thought he could really do it. He said, "I'm going to come to you," and he jumped off the table and broke his leg, you know. He thought he was divine, you know, he had played his own role so well. So so in bibliodrama I'm very careful and very slow and very respectful, of course, because those are very important texts. So fairy tales is wonderful. I love fairy tale enactment. You know, a fairy tale is just an archetypal presentation of things that have happened for thousands of years and have been collected and delivered to us, you know, by the great Andersons or Grimms. And so, you know, in their brutality and everything, but they have this, they're archetypal, they're not personal stories, really. So what we do in fairy tale enactment is that we assign the roles as they are needed in the fairy tale, and we act it out objectively, exactly as the fairy tale is. And then with some coaxing and direction, everybody gets a free shot at it and gets to do what he or she feels, how the fairy tale should really be lived. And then it becomes a subjective reenactment. And it's a lot of fun and very powerful. Very powerful. Well, it's a leap of faith, Betty. You know, once you believe in dreams, once you believe in the unconscious, or there is something there that we don't know, whether you call it unconscious, God, divine, inner self, inner child, I don't really care what you call it, as long as you believe in something that is out of our rational and scientific realm, then I think the only thing that almost everybody agrees on, we dream all the time. So I think they influence us no matter what we do with them.
I think they become more meaningful to our conscious life if we can harvest them in some fashion and work on them. And then, of course, they influence us. In the enactment, you know, it's so exciting to see that when there is a round and a protagonist walks around to pick role players. I just had it in New York where with colleagues we did it was a convention. And I was in a number of these interactive workshops that colleagues led, and one was a very powerful one that a Jewish woman did, and it was a personal and social drama, and of course in it she picked the role of Adolf Hitler. There were 30 of us in the room, about half men, half women. And I was sitting there and I said, I know I'm going to get picked. I knew it. She picked all the other roles. She walked around the room. She didn't even glance once or twice next to her. She said, will you play that role for me? She didn't know I was German. I was born in Germany. She didn't know what a hard role she gave me. But she got her money's worth, and so did I. You know, so it was—it's just amazing what happens. That in this role picking alone, how much Moreno called it tele, which is an expression I have a little bit of a problem with, because for me it's strictly an aspect of transference and countertransference on an unconscious level. What happens there in that group already? When somebody walks around and said, I need somebody to play my mother, and you look around for a while, and then suddenly you look at somebody and say, that's the person. And it always fits. And that person, when you ask that person, in 9 out of 10 cases, that person will say, I was sitting here and I was thinking, I know for sure I'm going to get picked. When I trained, in our training group in Zurich, where I did also my psychodrama training with a couple of wonderful Jungian analysts, for about 10 consecutive training weekends, I was picked as the angry son of a bitch father. So finally then about every 10 weekends we have sort of a group process weekend where we can let it all hang out. And I finally said, I need to de-roll from this. And so the group did a little insinuation for me in which I had the chance to get even with that angry son of a bitch father image and get rid of it. So it's, and what was it really was that I'm about as far removed in my reality, and I can say that with conviction, from being an angry son of a bitch father. But don't forget the aspect of compensation. I needed to get in touch with the opposite because I had trouble being angry. That's why I got picked. Not because I looked so angry or a son of a bitch. So I got my training in getting angry. So that was valuable. But, you know, there's so much of it you want to do. May I go? He had his hand up last time, and I think so at least. So like actors acting out something, like composers, music, visual arts. Well, I think, you know, it's this aspect of the collective unconscious and the archetypal base that connects us, and I fully believe that because I think we all have something in common somewhere. An interesting piece that comes to mind, it may not address your point of query exactly, but there is also this aspect of playback theater. I don't know whether you have heard of playback theater. Playback theater is a kissing cousin of psychodrama, or the other way around. I don't want to diminish my playback theater colleagues, because it's a wonderful practice. But it works roughly as such. Like we would be in a playback theater performance here. Here would be my group, and I, let us say, would be the teller. So somebody comes up and say, I have a story. So you sit down and we talk, you tell me the story. Then I, as the teller, I will reduce this story to 4 or 5 major aspects, similar to a psychodrama. Then, and that's the difference from the psychodrama, without further role training, without further instructions, the actors of the playback group will act and play out your drama without you having any insight. And you will be amazed how close to the core they get and how often. And I think that's something that you just, I had a sense that's what you alluded to. To go into the community and share this is absolutely right. And it's possible. And there's good playback theaters here in Seattle. There are two very good groups.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.